I was in my car on the way to work, and it was just like a snap, boom, like, gonna turn off the interstate, and nope, kept going straight to a doctor I knew that would probably prescribe me what I wanted. Didn't make a phone call or anything. That ran itself out over about a year and a half. You know, where basically it was just fentanyl at the end, fentanyl and speed. The hallucinations started coming back, right? Like the hearing stuff, seeing stuff, staying up for long periods of time.
Welcome to Stories of Recovery, a podcast from our addiction treatment centers in Atlanta. I'm your host, Matt Shedd. Our guest on the podcast today is somebody who stays very close to Mar and comes back every Thursday to sit in groups with the men who are going through treatment now. But his story is a little unique, because although he came through Mar as a client, he didn't stay sober the whole time after leaving. Ladd shares with us today about what he learned at Mar, his relapse after treatment, and how the things he learned while he was here helped him to make it back into sobriety. Ladd is a good man. I really enjoyed getting to sit with him and to hear his story.
Like, I'd always drank, right, since college. And, you know, started to notice my drinking was a little bit different than my buddies, you know. These things like getting arrested and for various things, and then got married. And, you know, it was kind of that thing where I met friends, right? We moved from Columbus, where I went to college, Columbus State, to LaGrange. And, you know, I found some buddies that liked to drink like me. And, but always took it like a step further. But really, you know, when it started to show up is, you know, when opiates were introduced and, you know, starting off on basically making my way up to OxyContin, and, you know, then that ran its course as far as, you know, me racking up a ton of bills, man, and around town that my wife didn't know about. And then her finding out about that and me saying, hey, look, I've got this thing that's going on, right? I can't stop doing it. And, you know, then having really no clue at that point in time, like what addiction was, what alcoholism was, you know, I decided to go to the methadone clinic, you know, and went that route and got on a steadily worked my way up to a real high dose of that. And, wife ended up leaving. Of course, it didn't take me long to find another wife. And, you know, that seemed to straighten out life for about a year. And, yeah, man, until it didn't anymore. And I remember starting to, I'd been on opiates for so long that one of my buddies had a bunch of Adderall, and I started taking those along with it. Man, that took about a year to where, you know, I got up to taking 500-600 milligrams of that a day. And so that led to days and sometimes, you know, up to 2 weeks of staying awake. And then all the stuff that comes along with that, psychosis, hearing things, seeing things. And that starts to affect the job. I can't show up. Getting so strung out that I'm hearing these conversations that I'm starting to like record them on my phone and listen to them while I'm at work. And reality's just gone. Right. And, you know, the work would pull me in every once in a while and be like, dude, like you got to straighten up a little bit. And I could try to reel it back it would only last for so long, you know, maybe a week, maybe a month. And, you know, just in the end, man, before I came into Mar, I'd gone to a place to detox in Florida. And I think I stayed sober for like 2 days, man, after I got home and started it all over again. And I'd gotten fired from my job twice in like 3 months. They brought me back. I started doing the same thing, fired again, got another job. Hung in there for about 8 months until, you know, man, I was just, my life was in serious disarray. Stopped paying the house note. Yeah, man. And my wife was at that point was, she had just given birth to our daughter.
Second wife.
Yeah. Second wife. And, yeah, man, like I got fired again and, I would always get the same spiel from the employers, like the same message. Hey man, we love you. Like everybody likes you, but dude, we just can't like handle it anymore. Like what you're doing. And, that's the first person I sat down and for some reason I told that guy like over 30 minutes, like, man, this is what's going on in my life. And he was like, I want you to go and tell your wife, your mom and dad, like, we want you to get some help or whatever. And, so at that point, my brother had come through Mar about a year and a half, I think, before. And, so I was like, man, I got to go to treatment. And, I had really just run out of options. No more money. The house was going into foreclosure. Like I knew this was not getting better. Cause I tried all these things to make it better. None of it worked. And, so then I wound up at Mar. That's kind of how I got here.
So you get here. What was your first impression of Mar once you got here?
I remember like the physical withdrawals were so bad, man. It was coming off of, 180 milligram dose of methadone a day.
The detox from that is really tough. I've
brutal.
Heard.
Yeah. It was like 50 something days because I kept count while I was here, man. But I just remember, I remember an intense dislike for everybody I lived with and, begging, you know, at that point, the head of our community, like, look, man, like, I gotta move. I can't stay here with these guys. And, but just trying to make it through a day at first, man, like just really a lot of discomfort.
Now, looking back on that, do you think that was mainly like the physical withdrawals that was doing that? Or was it also kind of an emotional, you know, just the discomfort of being in a different environment as well?
Well, like knowing what I know now, like looking back on it, like I had no perspective on life in general, you know, I live day to day on how much comfort can I squeeze out of this day? What can I use outside of myself to bring me some comfort? Hmm. So I believe that this thing is a disease, right? Mental, physical, and spiritual. And, I don't think I had any treatment for any of those three things. So everything I was around, I disliked it. You know, it was, my perspective was just, I didn't know which, you know, what was up or what was down. So that was my go-to, right? If something's wrong, it's not me, it's somebody else.
So what, you know, you're pretty uncomfortable for a while. Did that start to shift at any point?
Yeah. And I don't know like a time frame, but I think looking back, it was, I'd been in this like wound up state for so long, you know, covering up this lie, you know, just, it was a scramble, right?
Yeah.
Like getting around some guys that had been similar, not maybe the exact situation, but I remember sitting around the apartments really vividly and watching just movies I'd seen 20 times, like starting to laugh and joke and like starting to see that discomfort slowly start to be like, okay, man, this is like, I'm waking up kind of looking forward to some of the stuff, you know, winding up in a place where, dang, like these are my guys, man. Mm-hmm. Like I just like being around them. So
the guys in your community.
Absolutely. Yeah. The guys in the community. And I guess I say I was fortunate in that scenario. There was, we had real young guys in there and then we had some older guys too. And, I had some guys in our community that could cook, you know? And, so we did a lot of like community meals back and forth.
Oh, cool.
Sitting around playing cards, you know, and just talking, man. And it was funny. Two of the guys that I did not like, man, when I first got there, that first week or two, because they were telling me stuff like, man, could you put your dishes in the dishwasher? Like this guy. But those became like some of the guys I was closest to, you know, towards the end. So it's pretty cool.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah.
Do you remember phase one of treatment and kind of the unique aspects of what you do in phase one, which is about 45 days or so, right?
Right. Like I was, you know, it went from that thing of just, I can't sit still when we go over here and meet at Mar and starting to get in these groups and people are sharing about stuff, about their feelings. And I, at some point, starting to participate a little bit, you know, and, really, man, like hearing guys say that, I can remember this, right? Talk about like they were scared of stuff, like fears and things like that, like I would never admit to before. But when I started to take a look at, and I couldn't really take a look at it by myself, it was really hearing somebody else share it. And it was like, gave me a little bit of freedom to go, you know what? Like, man, I feel that way too. So getting comfortable in that environment with a bunch of guys, learning how to be vulnerable. I remember there was freedom in that. And, you know, towards the end of that 45, 50 days, like starting to look forward to going to those groups and also starting to look forward to like when the newer guys came in and going like, man, I felt just like you did like that first week or two. Like here's how we do it, you know?
And there's some pretty important exercises you do during that phase one, too, like the first step exercise or 39s, mm-hmm. as we call it here, 39, coming up with 39 examples of powerlessness, and then the life story, right? That's in the mm-hmm. first. Do you have any memories of doing those?
At the time, like, this is I remember this pretty vividly. Like sitting out on the balcony one night, maybe it's like 10 o'clock at night, man. And I was like, I'm just coasting through this, kind of like I've coasted through the rest of my life, you know, my life up until that point has just been kind of getting by, right? And not putting a whole lot of work into whatever I'm doing and not taking any responsibility for anything. And like I'm sitting here, I'm doing it again. Like, if I want to do something different, I'm going to have to, like, I want to do something different, right? I'm going to start doing what they, like, following these rules. So giving these assignments to do, like, a life story, I'm not a person that's going to willingly do something like that. And I remember it being a task that I did not want to do. But I think I've learned a lot in recovery. Like for a while at least, it's a do what you don't want to do type deal. And so I was willing to sit down and do the life story. And I don't know, in the 39s, coming up with these examples, it wasn't a hard thing to come up with the examples, but to sit down and do the action for me was, you know, it's not necessarily something I wanted to do, man, but, you know, I saw other guys doing it. I saw other guys seem like that they were a little bit more free, you know? And so I did it. They asked me to do it and I did it begrudgingly, but I did it. So.
And what was it like sharing those with the group?
I don't know. I remember being scared, real scared to do it. And, but also probably feeling like at each little thing they asked me to do, like, and becoming somewhat willing to do them, like I felt like a part of the group, you know, like I've heard this guy's life story, this guy's 39s, and now they've heard mine, and there's almost like a deeper connection there. I remember thinking for the longest time, like I would have these examples in my life doing these things, right? Over and over and over again. These important things I need to show up to in life, whether it be a kid's ball game or a birthday party or work or, you know, just paying a bill. And I repeatedly couldn't do it. And I didn't understand why. I felt like I was the only person that like couldn't meet life's responsibilities. And I would do these crazy things that I could not explain to anybody. And, like hearing that they were like, I'm not different than these guys. Like, man, they did the same thing. Might be a little bit different, but you know, you too, you know, like, damn, me too, man. Like there was that connection there from that, because I just, man, I thought I was like a degenerate or something.
Yeah, right, you know what I mean?
So
yeah, relieve some of that guilt and shame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when you finish that first phase, there's the phase one review where you sit down kind of with the counselors and they go over your
mm-hmm.
your progress. And how do you have any memories of that?
So right before my phase one review, we went to the lake and Doug pulled me aside and told me my dad had died of a heart attack the night before.
Oh, wow.
And really unexpected. And but so it was, I can remember that had just happened like a week or two before. And you know, I don't know why I mentioned that, but it was, it happened. And, but it was also the first time, you know, I found that, really and truly like walking through a life situation, a problem, like talking to other alcoholics, like intense work with another alcoholic, mm-hmm. right. Is frees me up. And it did, it sort of, I was able, I guess, to listen to somebody else say, hey, man, this is what, like, I suggest that you do, like, share with these guys, talk to them about it. And that happened. And I remember the phase one review thinking one way about myself, right? I've always been that guy that's like, yeah, you don't like me. I don't quite fit in. Mm-hmm. Da, 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 da. And some of the counts are saying, like, man, like, we'd like to hang out with you. Like, you're a good guy. Like, you're a pretty cool dude or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, you're just saying that to make me feel better. Right. Yeah.
Right. So, but I got delivered some truths. I think that I was able, maybe not at that moment, but later on to look at and go, man, I think they were right. You know what I mean? I did get some, I thought I was different. Like the rules didn't apply to me a lot in life. I don't have to do this. I know everybody else does, but I don't have to. For some reason, like that was prevalent and my behavior kind of showed that pattern. And so even today when I look at, you know, yeah, that could be an example of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like me, I don't think that applies to me and it does.
Yeah. Was there anything for you significant about family week when the family comes and did you participate in that?
Yeah, I did. You know, at the time it had been, I don't know how long it had been since my dad had passed.
Oh, right.
You know, getting up in front of talking to my wife at the time and, you know, telling her like I was wrong. I did these things. I lied. I stole. You know, I was irresponsible with our money. I put you in a position where you don't know what's coming in, going out, where we are in life. And, just made her scared to death. You know, hey, I did that. It wasn't the job that did that. It wasn't the this, the that. It was me. Man, it's really like I'd never done that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I don't think I could have come up with that on my own either. Somebody had to say, like, you need to do this, lad.
Right.
And so I did it, and that was pretty powerful. And then there were guys, too, there that had their moms and fathers there, and I got to see that, and that sort of just remember it being emotional.
Mm.
So,
yeah. Was there anything else significant about phase two for you that happened?
Yeah, I remember at some point, and I don't know when it happened, there was a kind of a conscious decision as between, you know, some of us there, man, that we were going to actually try to follow the rules that were in place and, to the best of our ability, try to do the right thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, in that it was kind of like, I watched other guys do it, like start to help out like a new person, you know, show them where they need to be, like trying to help them out with a life story or 39s, having talks on the porch at night with them, you know, or on the car ride over to Mar or the lake or to a meeting or something like that. Like to then get towards the back end of it and start to practice that, like people have practiced it with me, was like a really cool experience, you know?
Yeah, it's powerful to see that transformation of being the one, seeing yourself being the newcomer to now being the more experienced one, helping others in.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, I needed it when I, man, like if I had a couple guys, the first guy I met when I walked into Mar was Sam Hart, and like we hit it off, man, and like there was a couple of guys that had been there for a while that like talked to me, how's it going on, how's it going, you know, how's life treating you, feeling okay, you know, type deal. And dude, that was like, it might have seemed small, I don't know, to them, but it was really big, you know, if somebody just asked me those questions, you know, and sit down with me and talk to me. So yeah,
absolutely. So did you stay for phase three or the three quarters?
Mm-hmm. I did.
And then, so tell me about what happened after, you know, going back to your life, and
mm-hmm.
were you still, it sounds like you're still married.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And are you still married to that
mm-hmm.
person? Okay.
Yep.
And you got four kids, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So what was it like reintegrating back into your life?
Brutal. From my point of view at the time, like now I look at it as like it was necessary. And, but yeah, going home, the thing that was, at the time, like I'd learned some tools at Mar, you know, main thing is, I don't know if it's the main thing, but one of the things was, pick up the phone and talk to people and go to meetings. And I did that. And I got to a point where it was extremely painful. And,
what was painful?
Painful is like the, so not having a job. And I don't know if that was in itself painful really, but it was more the emotions, right? Like, at this point, having like a little bit of treatment for my alcoholism, you know, and then going home with that, you know, to a different city without a sponsor, and just the emotions, dude. Like it was like they were I couldn't control them, and you know, but it led me, you know, at some point to make some calls and somebody saying, look, Dave, man, I would, if I were you, I would suggest you get a sponsor and have that person take you through the steps. So that's what happened.
So you get a sponsor back home and work the steps. And it sounds like from the dates that you gave me, it sounds like there was a relapse.
Yes.
So tell me about what led up to that and that process of coming back in too.
Yeah. So yeah, I think I was about 10 or 11 months sober, and it was funny, man. I asked a guy to sponsor me, and he said, "Yeah, I'll sponsor you." I just took another job. He worked with the railroad, right? And he said, "I've got 8 weeks where I don't have to work. Like we can meet up here. There was a clubhouse." And he met me every day, man, and took me through the steps. And, you know, I had a pretty dramatic shift in perspective, psychic change, spiritual awakening, whatever you want to call it. It was, life looked completely different. And it was when I was making my amends to the employee, they hired me, and You know, I think sobriety lasted for about 3.5 years, and relapse. I don't know exactly what time, but I can make up, like, because I can even hear it inside my head now, like, this is what happened. You know, these not excuses, but to my mind, it's like, well, this is what happened, man. And it's like, I took a job in another city. It was the same dealership in a different city. And so it was like I was doing 12-step recovery in one town, in LaGrange, and then working in Auburn. So sort of, I guess the emphasis on like the fellowship this time around has been like extremely important in my life. But leading up to that, I guess my sponsor always says, he tells me like the spiritual beam, right? You can't get too far away where you can't reach back out and touch it. And I just kind of lost all connection with, you know, the meeting attendance went down. Things were going really good at work. Like, you know, there was really nothing going on in my life that was bad at the time. And, you know, I got to a point where I was just going to kind of do this thing, by myself. And, there came that time where I had no mental defense against the first drink or drug. And, yeah, I relapsed, went to the doctor, had like an incident, right? And didn't tell them, hey, look, man, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. Like, this is what I can't have, you know? And they gave me some hydrocodone. And it was the first one, and I didn't call anybody. And what was crazy about it, I was in my car on the way to work, and it was just like a snap, boom, like, gonna turn off the interstate, and nope, kept going straight to the doctor's office. And to a doctor I knew that would probably prescribe me what I wanted. Didn't make a phone call or anything. And, man, once that started, I couldn't stop it. It was, and I knew it, like, oh God. And that ran itself out over about a year and a half, and was making the curve right around to where, like, it was opiates and, you know, where basically it was just fentanyl at the end, fentanyl and speed. And, the hallucinations started coming back, right? Like the hearing stuff, seeing stuff, staying up for long periods of time. And I just remember at work, cause at this point I had moved, they had transferred me back to the LaGrange office. Like, I lost a lot of stuff. I was losing a lot of material things the first time I came in to sobriety, right? It was the house, the job, money, all these outside things being taken away and losing it. And the second time around, none of those things were happening, but I was dead on the inside. Like, I was so tired. I can't really explain that feeling of I cannot live this way anymore. I was just done. And told my boss, man, I got to go somewhere for a little while. And went to a treatment center, supposed to stay 60 days, something like that. And I called a guy that I knew I wanted to ask to sponsor me. And anyway, so I left there and went straight to his house. And had a couple of weeks before I started back to work, and we started working the steps, man. And, you know, there's a counselor here all the time. So Matt Irwin always talks about powerlessness, and like, for me to really realize like what that is, there's nothing I can do to stay sober on my own. I can't will it. I can't do, you know, I don't have the sufficient power to keep myself sober. And, you know, and realizing that, because I saw it firsthand, like, hey, man, I worked the steps before. Life got real good. You know, promotions at work, these things happening. And like I forgot that I was powerless, or maybe I never knew it in the first place. I don't know, but it was very apparent to me coming back in, like, it's either I get busy living this way of life, you know, which consists of a lot of meetings, a lot of phone calls to alcoholics and addicts during the day, like retreats. We go to 3 retreats a year. Coming up tomorrow on Thursdays, like, you know, asking every day for this, like, hey, keep God, keep me sober. And then taking the actions that have been suggested. Just working so far. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long were you out
about,
using?
I think about a year and a half.
Okay.
Maybe close to 2 years, I think.
And how was that, like, what effect did that have on your family? And did they know?
Yeah, it became pretty apparent at some point. And I, you know, I didn't mention that when I said I was, you know, hey, I can't live this way anymore. It's, yes, that's true, but it's really, oh my God, I'm torturing the people I live with on a daily basis. Like, I'm inconsistent. They don't know when I'm going to show up, when I'm not going to show up. Like, yeah, man, a lot of, you know, reliving what they relived before, especially my wife. And so, yeah, absolutely. It had effects on them.
Hmm. And was your time at Mar helpful in terms of, like, having some foundation to draw on in terms of getting back sober again?
Yeah, I called the guys from Mar, like, when I knew that this was something I had to do. Mm. And I say it was, I guess, it's something I had to do, but I just knew. So I called my sponsor and just said, hey, man, I thought I knew how to stay sober. Apparently I don't. Just tell me what to do. There was a lot of those conversations with guys from Mar and some of the counselors. And like, my time at Mar taught me a lot of the basic fundamentals of what it looks like to be in recovery and being vulnerable with other guys. And, so I always can kind of look back on that, and like, the foundation was kind of my time spent here, is where I learned a lot about what alcoholism and addiction is, and kind of what to do in recovery.
Yeah, for sure. I really loved your story because it shows the kind of spirit of this place too, that you could, it wasn't like, oh, you relapsed. You're not a patient of ours anymore, so we can't help you. It was like,
right.
Counselors were there for you. The guys you went through treatment were there for you.
Yep.
It was like this resource that you could draw on, as a alumni from this program, mm-hmm. that you didn't even have to re-enroll here to get
right.
a lot of the benefits that
yeah.
you got.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact too, the thing I love, about your story too, is that now you come here every Thursday and just hang out, volunteer, and just here. It's like, now you're providing that same thing that you got, for other people. And I know you'll probably say, well, it helps me, but it's pretty, I mean, your whole story is just kind of a testament to how this place can really get, you know, there's something special about it, and it kind of draws you in and nourishes, can nourish someone's sobriety for a long time after they finish treatment here.
Like what you said, I've heard so many people say, this is a special place. And like, I can go into a bunch of adjectives, and this is how it is. And it just, if you've been here, you've been around these guys, the people that work here, like guys that you go through treatment with, for me, it became a special place. And, it's funny. I went to Atlanta Men's Workshop last, March, and like, there was a bunch of dudes, man, that went through Mar, and I started talking to them, and I was like, man, I got this day off or whatever, and started, just made some calls up here and started to come up here on Thursday. And yes, I don't know no clue if I help anybody, man, but like seeing, just showing up in recovery, man. Like I, a lot of this stuff to me is, as I go along, it's not like I've been sober a long time or anything like that, but you know, just to get up and show up every day, you know, and stuff just starts to look different, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't even know if I necessarily like have to believe that what you're telling me like works, but like just knowing the fact that through my repeated efforts, right? Like I know what I'm doing doesn't work. Like right now in my life, you know, and to go to somebody else and say, man, like, how do I do this thing? Like, help me out. And then it's like something opens up if I'm willing to do that. There is a solution for me. I've experienced living life where my life starts to get full with like other people. And I can't really describe how that's happened. It's just happened. And I'm grateful for it.
All right, that's it for this episode of Stories of Recovery. I'm your host, Matt Shedd. Our executive producer is David Tate. Thank you so much for joining us, and we're already looking forward to having you again next time.